on Tilly. Sean Tilly. From its launch in 1967 right through the 70s to the mid-80s, BBC Radio 1 was probably the world's biggest music station. In this series, I'll be introducing you to many of the people behind the network's success during those golden years as they each tell the story of their Radio 1. And of course, it was more than just about the music. This jingle goes some way to revealing our next guest. Radio 1. It's Frank Partridge.
Thanks, Sean. And on this edition of My Radio 1, I'll tell you about the astonishing difference I experienced personally between Bob Marley and Genesis, how I ended up in the wrong studio seconds before going on air, and the time Paul McCartney's faulty microphone let me down big time during Live Aid.
Oh, he's still got it.
Yes, shut up.
Frank, how lovely to see you.
Very nice writing you've got. So, somebody sent you a letter and you haven't opened it.
I think it says, oh, yeah, there's a fee there as well.
Oh, so, great.
Yeah, but
great.
We won't mention that. Use beat. When was it exactly, Frank, when you experienced the hustle and bustle of a newsroom for the very first time?
I came from local radio, like many of us did.
And where was that?
Blackburn, Lancashire.
Ah.
Now it's called Radio Lancashire, actually. They've moved it to Preston. And really, I put a pin in the map, but I had been lucky enough to go through journalism college after my degree in Cardiff, South Wales, which you know very well, I think. Mm. And in those days, there were only one or two media studies courses. Now there are about 65, and so there are more people coming out of media studies courses than there are places in journalism. But in our day, we had 15 coming out each year. There were very few others doing the same thing, so we were virtually guaranteed a job, you know, if we applied for it. And I applied for four or five jobs, and most of them were offered to me, and one of the ones that came up was Radio Blackburn in Lancashire, which got me into the BBC. Mm. And then about a year later, with this bit of luck and timing and quite a good trial down here in London, I joined Newsbeat as a reporter in 78.
It was John Hunt who was the editor in those days, and he spotted you, didn't he?
He did a tour of the regions to find unearthed talent, and actually arrived at about 2:30 in the afternoon, and I'd been in the pub. We used to all drink at lunchtime in those days. Never happens now, of course. And I came back, and I'd had couple of pints, and so my natural politeness deserted me for a moment. There was this guy sitting in my chair on the news desk, and normally I'd have said, excuse me, could I have my chair back? This time I was a little bit more decisive, and I think he quite liked the chutzpah of it. And we had a chat, and he invited me down, did a week's trial, and one thing led to another.
Yeah, your first chance to shine was in 1979, and it was that rather strange 10-minute news beat that we had in between Mike Reed's show and John Peel's programme starting.
Right, 9:50 in the evening, yeah. 10 to 10, and it went into dun 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 yeah. at the end, and it was the first time that we had to do it to the second. You know, I mean, it's, everybody does it now, you do it on television a lot, and I can do it in my sleep now, but right then it was quite nerve-wracking, because we didn't have a count. We didn't have an earpiece with somebody counting us down. We had to do it by looking at the clock, which was new to me. So that made me very nervous. And we used to always end with a one-minute feature called Tomorrow's News Tonight. And basically, it was the news prospects that we just sort of copied out. But yeah, that was my first direct presentation job, and, you know, nationally. And, you know, it wasn't long before that went. But we started just, you know, increasing our presence around the airwaves,
yes,
with breakfast and half-hour news bulletins and so on.
It's now 12:30, and here's Frank Partridge.
Thanks a lot, Andy. And on the lunchtime news beat, the plan to abolish O and A levels and the woman who won a husband in a darts match.
And with this came new team members, people that we'll also be talking to on this series, the likes of Janet Trewin and Ian Parkinson.
Never heard of them.
Well, I was going to say, they've heard of you. They've told me all sorts of things. But up until this point, Frank, we had the Radio 2 news readers were reading on the half hour, weren't they? But all that was going to change.
Yep, and we took it over ourselves. And I think there was some concern, you know, are these guys up to it? And can they do it? And also, I think, you know, among the Radio 1 music devotees, there was far too much speech creeping in. But, you know, it seemed to go down pretty well. You know, the breakfast show had a distinctive sound of its own, and you know, the 12:30 and 5:30 programmes survived. So, you know, our empire gradually grew.
Yeah. So, from Heartbeat to Newsbeat with Frank Partridge.
Thanks, Paul. And today we ask, why is whooping cough vaccine not available to some children? And discover some of the craziest ways to play practical jokes. Radio 1. Headlines first. Our correspondent in Israel.
To produce a 15-minute Newsbeat programme, how long would that usually take?
Well, I mean, we turn up in the morning at 8 o'clock, actually, with a blank sheet of paper. And we would then, you know, read the papers and do the other things that you do to bring forward ideas. Have an editorial meeting at about 8:45, I think. And all the ideas chucked into the pot then. I mean, some of them were self-evident. If you're at war with Argentina over the Falklands, you know, you don't need to be a bright idea to do it. Or if there's a space shuttle disaster or all the other big stories that occurred in the 80s. The very first really big story that came my way was, tragically, the shooting of John Lennon in December 1980.
Yeah. The man accused of murdering John Lennon outside his apartment in Manhattan has appeared in court. He was remanded for psychiatric examination. Here's Keith Hindle.
Mark David Chapman, who's 25 and lives in Hawaii, was charged in Manhattan Criminal Court with second-degree murder.
Everybody would chuck ideas in. The editor of the day would then produce a sort of, you know, putative rundown for the 12:30 programme. Some of that would be left for the 5:30. And then from about 9 o'clock, we'd get down to it. And it's only 15 minutes, not huge. It was quite a reasonable staff at the time. Mm. And, you know, I know there have been cutbacks, but no, I think, you know, we never felt ourselves really short-handed. And, you know, as the morning developed, tension rose and it got a little bit more frenetic. Do the 12:30 programme, quite a long lunch hour, and then come back and do it all again in the afternoon.
Well, that's right, yeah. Because whoever was doing it at lunchtime was also coming back and doing it in the evening.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So, I mean, once I took over as presenter in 82, I didn't go down to the BBC club or the local pubs for three pints, you know, because I knew that a disaster could occur on the second programme if I did what everybody else did.
Beirut is reported calm this morning after an outbreak of shelling during the night. The United Nations Security Council is to meet again later today to continue its discussion of a Soviet call for a ban on military aid to Israel. An earlier session broke up after angry words between delegates. In an hour's time, why British jobs are threatened because of a Romanian car, and how the terrorist threat is making politicians in Italy camp down in their offices. Those and all today's top news stories on the Lunchtime Newsbeat at 12:30.
When you first joined, it was Laurie Mayer, Richard Skinner and Peter Main who were the anchors of Newsbeat. But gradually, you became the main presenter. How did that happen?
I'd actually done quite a few Newsbeats and was a fairly regular presenter when John Hunt just announced casually, one after lunch one day, oh, by the way, Frank's the new presenter, permanently. And nobody booed, and so I kept the job.
Frank Partridge reporting, this lunchtime we ask, were Merseyside police justified in imposing a news blackout on trouble in Toxteth?
Being a news magazine programme, you could be, say, interviewing a politician one day, and then, with it being Radio 1, the very next day you could be chatting to a pop star. I mean, that was how it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the funny thing about it, before we all got invited in to do this show, you asked us to think about anecdotes that, you know, sum up our time there. And actually, the ones I've picked out aren't representative particularly of, you know, most days it was an office job. I mean, we didn't have computers in those days or mobile phones, but we had clanky typewriters. Everybody smoked, including one guy who smoked a pipe that sort of fumigated the whole floor of Broadcasting House. And and actually, for much of the time, it was like an office job on speed, if you like. You know, it was clear that it wasn't just an office job, you know, because there was a certain amount of glamour and adrenaline attached that you wouldn't get if you're sitting in reception answering the phone, you know. But yeah, so most days were just actually they were 8 to 6 rather than 9 to 5, and we only did a 4-day week. But most days were fairly humdrum, except that you'd occasionally interview Michael Heseltine or Bob Marley.
Tell me about your Bob Marley interview. Okay. Only because I know what you're going to say. This is a wonderful story, though.
Okay. Well, by coincidence, I was doing quite a lot of pop interviews Around this time. And in the same week, I was asked to interview Bob Marley, who was over on tour and promoting an album, which I think was his last, actually. He died in the middle of 81, and I think this would have been 80. And then Genesis, who were changing from being a sort of progressive rock band into the Phil Collins version, you know, which was very different. And I had to interview, I think, Bob on the Wednesday and Genesis on the Friday or something like that. So, but 2 days apart, Bob was staying in a very fine four or five star hotel not far from Broadcasting House, went to his suite, was introduced to him, and immediately it was clear that a certain number of illicit drugs were being taken. And this was reasonably early in the morning, it was about 10 o'clock. And while we were sort of lining up, you know, sort of checking the tape recorder and all that, I was suddenly aware that he was rolling the largest joint I have seen in my entire life. It was enormous. And he proceeded to smoke it throughout the interview. He didn't offer me any, I have to say.
Well, he knew that you didn't drink at lunchtime.
Yeah, but the funny thing was, or not very funny thing, because it was terrible to go back to Broadcasting House with an unusable interview, but actually when we played it back, you couldn't really make out what he was saying.
Well, where if you know, I was born, you know, and then born and outgrowing. There was a certain amount of consciousness in myself that, you know, it was always a lonely world, not finding people who might think like me, you know.
2 days later, having had this disaster but completely memorable experience, Genesis were coming in to the studio this time, and it was sort of Mike Rutherford, I remember, but most of all Tony Banks walking in, suited and booted, with wearing ties, and Tony Banks was carrying a copy of the Financial Times under his arm. Could there be a greater contrast?
No, he was checking his royalties on the stock
exchange.
We never expected to become successful, I don't think, really, although we always had the confidence that we could do it. It's a kind of a double thing. We always knew that we were a good group, that if we kept going and we could had a bit of few breaks, which we have had, that we could be successful, I suppose, from that point of view. But then you never feel you're actually going to get those breaks. There are so many moments. It takes such a long time. I mean, Genesis has in fact existed in one form or another for 10 years. And you just don't feel you're ever really going to sort of get there.
It's strange, isn't it? Because you were a household voice. You were heard on the nation's biggest radio station every day. You could walk down the street without anybody recognising you.
That's true. Although in time, obviously, I did more and more TV. But also appearing for the Radio 1 football team. Sort of put your name on posters and things.
What position were you?
Well, actually, I was a deep-lying number 10. a kind of Martin Peters role. If you go back to the World Cup in 66,
yes.
Or a Maradona, you might say. My job was to get the ball and get it to the stars. And John Peel played right wing.
Yeah.
I've got a picture of him playing one game in which I'm in the middle of the park, and on my left is Paul Gambaccini, who I don't think was a great player, and on my right was Richard Skinner. So, you know, it was an eclectic group of footballers, but there were one or two. There was the guy that did the post in Radio 1, used to come round, you know, delivering the post.
Yeah.
He was a very good player, and I was reasonable. And three or four of us were there to get the ball, because otherwise, because if you just got these clowns who are messing about, you're never actually going to get a game. And some of the teams that we played Norwich, we played Birmingham, we played Meadowbank Stadium in Edinburgh, which was this, hosted the Commonwealth Games. Big crowds turned up.
Huge,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, we had something like 32,000 at Carrow Road in Norwich. I mean, that was a pretty big crowd.
That's as big as what they were getting for a home game.
Absolutely. And, you know, I remember at Meadowbank, Noel Edmonds turned up in a helicopter and came off the helicopter in his shorts to play second half or something. But I do remember with great pride day at Meadowbank, we were playing BBC Scotland, and there was a giant scoreboard, and some wag had put, you know, in huge letters, Radio 1 and then Scotland. And it wasn't Scotland at all. It was BBC Scotland, nothing to do with Scotland. But anyway, after about 10 minutes, I scored. And so for the rest of the first half, and it was 1-0 at half time. It had Radio 1 1, Scotland 0, with Partridge.
Yay!
Yeah, yeah. And I was, my wife was there and friends and so on. And I was trying to get a picture of this, signalling
so
to them.
It's so easy now, wouldn't they, with a mobile phone?
And they didn't. Yeah. They failed to do it. So I could be making that up.
Yeah, yeah. No, somehow I believe.
Hundreds of South Wales miners have gathered at their union headquarters in Pontypridd in a massive show of strength. They're backing their leaders, who are refusing to pay a £50,000 fine for contempt of court. It's thought that court officials may try to seize the union's funds later today. From the scene, Chris Powell.
The miners have virtually taken the third floor of their Pontypridd headquarters by siege.
I mean, things could get a bit hairy from time to time, couldn't they? Such as when you found yourself in the wrong studio literally seconds before going on air.
When I was at Broadcasting House, there was always a lot of engineering work going on. You know, there was banging and crashing all the time because it was a kind of organic building. It was always changing. Even the building we're in now has changed many times, and it's named, you know, since I was working here. And so on one occasion, we had been allocated Studio 4A, for the sake of argument, rather than our normal studio, which was 3A. I can't remember the numbers now. There was one particular day when something went wrong. It was very late getting the scripts. I was late dictating them. You know, somebody else was held up in traffic. The regular engineer was ill that day. There were a chapter of accidents, and I turned up in the studio at something like 45 seconds before we were on air, and it was the wrong studio. On the wrong floor. And so half our team were directly above me. Some of them have come with me because they've made the same mistake because we kept getting moved around.
Yeah.
I got out of there, you know, sprinted as fast as I've ever sprinted. Big mistake. Got into the right studio. Everybody was panicking through the glass. What was I? Completely out of breath.
Yeah.
And, you know, I literally took the steps five at a time, got in. Just about got the you know the three headlines before the sting in, but the more I tried to read the intro, the worse it got. I don't know if you've been in that position, but any time you start clamming up, your breath gets tighter and tighter and tighter. But it infected the whole place. A guy had to come in to do a live voice piece during the show, and it was almost like this nerve agent had had infected everybody. Mm. The engineer, the guy twiddling the knobs, started making fundamental errors.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah. And you had this it was almost like the plague went through it. And the guy that came in to the studio, he got out of breath, you know, as well as me. I never recovered my breath because it was a pretty breathless program anyway, you know. It raced along. And it came to the end of the program. I thought, I'm going to be sacked. And then I was walking up back to the office thinking, I've got 15 seconds and then my BBC career's over. I thought, oh, hang
really?
On.
Seriously, I thought, you were thinking that?
I did think that. You always think that after a bad show because you're only as good as your last show.
Well, it was so high profile.
It was embarrassing. And two things came. As I walked, I thought, well, hang on, everybody else was useless as well. They can't sack everybody. And secondly, we had this thing called the ROT, which is a recording of transmission, every tape. Mysteriously, that tape disappeared, never to be found again.
This is brilliant. We're getting an exclusive here, quite right, as we're talking to Frank Partridge about Newsweek.
It's in my garage, actually.
I knew it. Far too honest for your own good.
New Year's Eve on Radio 1, and while you're getting ready for the party, Newsbeat gives you the chance to meet again the people who made the news in 82. The Royals.
How is Lady Di?
She's very well.
It's a very painful experience.
Have you ever had a baby?
No, I haven't.
I should wait and see.
There's the wives who waited through war in the Falklands.
I heard the news on the TV, first of all, that Sheffield had been hit and that, and then it was 5 o'clock this morning I found out I was one of the lucky ones.
The tycoon who gambled on a space-age car and lost.
I still have sold more cars than any human being that ever lived in one single year. I know how to sell automobiles. Unfortunately, it's like trying to dance in wet cement.
And some of the crazy people who made us laugh with everything from walking fish to ferocious
Vicious Ferrets.
You got the first one going out your right leg. How do you feel at the moment?
I'm pretty nervous, I'll tell you. It's just... Oh, he's close. Oh.
Join them and us for a look back at the news and the music of 82. That's Newsbeat 5:30 on New Year's Eve.
There was those terrific Newsbeat reviews at the end of each year that you used to front.
I loved them. I absolutely
loved
them.
How much work would go into those?
Actually, the producer and myself would leave the programme proper for 2 weeks before, and then go through all this stuff.
Korean Air 007, clear out. Korean Air 007.
We did one TV show, and when we walked on, everybody went, that's Culture Club? My God.
I should inform the House that earlier today, the first cruise missiles were delivered...
There was never a dull moment in 1983. It was the year the Korean airliner was shot down, the year of the peace campaigners and the coming of cruise missiles to Britain, a year of chart-topping for Men at Work, despair for men out of work. This Friday night on Radio 1, Newsbeat brings you the people, the action and the music that made the last 12 months. So join me, Frank Partridge, for Newsbeat 83 at 5:30 on Friday.
I mean, now you can go through the archives and access things pretty quickly and edit things very... But then it was all reel-to-reel tapes and... Some of them had been mislabeled, others had been lost, somebody had borrowed one and not returned it. And so it was a massive amount of stuff to listen through to, and then to put them together and make the current affairs and the events fit the music. Mm. It was wonderful. It was a great opportunity for creativity that you didn't have in a normal run-of-the-mill 15-minute programme.
Bob Geldof had been a backstage advisor on USA for Africa, but already he was working on a project that would top the lot. On July the 13th, he delivered his masterstroke. Simply the greatest rock event of all time.
It's 12 noon in London, 7 a.m. in Philadelphia, and around the world it's time for Live Aid. 16 hours of live music in aid of famine relief in Africa. Wembley welcomes their Royal Highnesses, the Prince and Princess of Wales.
Live Aid, the global jukebox. At some time or another on that seemingly endless summer day, 1,500 million people in 160 countries tuned in to the twin spectacle at Wembley and Philadelphia.
I think then the scale of the thing hit me when I saw all those people and the atmosphere of the thing, you know. It's not like any other rock gig I've been to.
The technological challenge of the worldwide hookup stretched the sound, vision and telecommunications engineers to the limit. Astonishingly, it worked. For 3 days, the switchboards hummed with pledges of money. One caller, an Arab racehorse owner, donated £1 million as the funds soared towards 50 million. Even the weather answered the prayers of the man they were now calling Saint Bob. The sun at Wembley so fierce, they cooled the crowd with water jets. And performers like Howard Jones realised they'd helped create a moment of history.
It would have been worth it just to do one note, I think. I mean, it's been such a great atmosphere out there, and it's such an occasion. You know, I would have done anything to be on it.
Among the all-night revellers, David Bowie.
This kind of situation has to become an annual event. It really does. Ethiopia can only be helped to a certain extent in 1 year, but it has to be an ongoing situation. And I think a lot of us would pledge to do a show like this every year until starvation in many areas of the world, not just Ethiopia, was under some kind of control. I'd do it again next year like a shot.
Okay! Tokyo!
But on the actual day of Live Aid, you were there in the studio and we got to see you read the news on the TV for the first time.
I flew down from Inverness that morning. I was on holiday. Came to Wembley. Wonderful experience. And... but I started to get nervous, but not about appearing on TV. That was excellent, and you know, one was aware that it was the biggest audience ever. You know, and I mean, I had done a little bit of Saturday morning stuff with John Craven, Newsround, and that kind of thing, but you know, to go on, you know, on a day like that, and it, you know, it was just the perfect day.
And back here at Wembley, happier news: the donations to the Live Aid appeal now total around £228,000.
But in the evening. The BBC never sleeps, as you know. There's World Service, there's the regions, there's the networks in radio, there's television, and if you're not careful, if you happen to be in front of a microphone in a place where there aren't other reporters, you can end up doing a lot of work that you hadn't anticipated. Now, I'm not averse to work, but it was starting to come in. You know, World Service want 45 seconds, such and such want this, Radio Wales want something. And so I did more and more. But because everything had to be scripted and, you know, time was running out, I thought, right, OK, there's going to be a huge build-up for the midnight news on Radio 4 and Radio 1 and Radio 2. I better write it in advance. And, of course, we knew the running order and we knew that Paul McCartney was finishing the show and we knew that it was going to be Let It Be, that he'd be playing on the piano. So I wrote it and said, you know, it was an incredible day, Freddie Mercury, epic, you know, all the other performers. The Simple Minds was one that stood out for me. I thought they were just great that day. And wrote, it ended up with Paul McCartney at his most resplendent, delivering an impeccable version of the Beatles' Let It Be. What a day it's been. Good night from Wembley Stadium, sort of thing, OK? And that would have been fine had Paul's microphones worked. And I don't know if you remember, but actually it was a bit of a disaster. And you couldn't actually hear him in the stadium, and there was booing and jeering and all that kind of thing. But my piece still went out. So, you know, I think that the moral of the story is any future journalists or producers or DJs listening, don't write the future before it's happened.
You've gone on and had an incredible career, firstly with BBC Radio 4, and then there was Sky News for many, many years. But you must feel incredibly proud of your time at Radio 1, looking back, because you were there for such a long time, weren't you?
10 years. Yeah, yeah. And although I was doing other things, and increasingly after Sport Aid and Live Aid, I was doing more and more travelling in Africa and Central America doing aid stuff. So that although I was still turning up at Newsbeat, I wasn't there so often. But yeah, in effect, it was 10 years. And, you know, it was what a training ground. You know, it was really my entry into serious journalism, broadcasting, into, you know, serious network operation. And you know, after that, after you've been you know, reaching millions every day and you become a household name, but as you say, not a household face, you're not really scared of anything. You can deal with anything. And if you've done three elections and a space shuttle disaster and a Falklands war and eight budgets, you know, then you can look back on it and say, well, yeah, there were a few highlights there.
Frank, it's so lovely to see you, and thank you very much for sharing your Radio 1.
Sorry I've been so over the top.
Not at all. I wouldn't expect anything else. It's really good to see you, and thank you.
Thank you, Sean.